This is a presentation of the Badlands Media Network.
Explain those Badlands. That's a hell of a name.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Rattlegator Report for Friday, April 26, 2024. This is episode 17.3. And I welcome you and I thank you for joining me this morning. I'm reflecting back on my travel and my perhaps impatience. You may have seen some of that displayed in the show. Wednesday, I drove back to Jacksonville, and I had debated going to Tampa or going further southeast in South Florida and watch draft night with my Irish twin brother. I decided against that because I was incredibly tired and, wow, I didn't plug in. Anyway, and I'm still tired and ignoring some things that I need to do in terms of prep for the show and getting situated. I am more than likely driving on Sunday to Tallahassee for a Monday funeral. I don't know if I'm going to do the show yet on Monday morning, any show on Monday. I'm just going to have to decide that later today. So we shall see. There may be no show at all on Monday Sports Talk or the Rattlegator Report. But, I do find myself bouncing around quite a bit, thinking about the experience that I have, some of the situations I've observed over the 40 plus years since I began my university education, and even some of the stuff I saw while in high school and in the United States Army. And I think it's somehow applicable. I put in the chat today, in fact, let me get over here. I put in the chat a link to a, you know what, let me go ahead and present her. Ayan Hirsi Ali is a chick I've just been incredibly impressed with for years. And I'm not going to read her post, but I'm going to share. Okay, wow. Let me get rid of this. Let me get rid of that background. I'm just going to share her post for those listening to the podcast. She posted something yesterday and linked to a column she's written. But her post was, "What we are witnessing is the complete subversion of our universities. We don't produce academic professionals, but professional activists. Condemnations are not enough to fix this. People and institutions must be punished." And she invites you to read her latest. Now, I'm going to click that and show you. You know, it doesn't work like that, huh? Why is... I'm going to stop sharing. I just learned something. You know, I'm so slow on the uptake in terms of this StreamYard platform and testing it out to see what it does and how it does it. I had planned on not reading any of this, but I think to start the day, maybe I should at least read this beginning. A very brief history of the university, because I think that is important in terms of understanding how we've gotten off track. This is how she begins her piece. "The first question we must ask is, what are universities even for? It is not an easy one. They began as institutions to train clerics in theology and philosophy and evolved gradually into places for training gentlemen scholars. Oxford and Cambridge in the 19th century did not live up to the model St. John Henry Newman describes in The Idea of a University, but they did a much better job than we do today. Over time, led by the Germans, universities became multiversities where scholars ceased to attempt to build a comprehensive view of the world, instead locking themselves in siloed subfields." Now, I think this may be, you know, look, we're an Anglo-Germanic country, I've said to you, in my estimation, and more Germanic than people realize. And the whole British-German thing, I think Ayan may be heavily influenced by the British. We followed the German model, and it wasn't just them becoming multiversities, and if I recall correctly, but those PhDs were broad in the German system as well as the British system, and they have evolved into becoming something of silos, okay? And that's what she's getting at here. And then she moves on to, "Next, American universities led the transition away from scholarship and towards professionalization. People started studying business arts as if business were the same sort of activity as the pursuit of truth for its own sake. I have nothing against business. Making a good living for one's family is noble. But insofar as it is an art, it is a servile one, not a liberal one. Accompanying professionalization was, paradoxically, radicalization. People who wanted to get on with life started studying to be accountants and engineers. Radicals took over what remained of the liberal arts. This decay is best chronicled by Alan Bloom in The Closing of the American Mind, a book I encourage you all to read." Okay, I'm going to stop there. I agree. I have not read the book. I've briefed it, but I heard my phone. That is good advice. There's a lot going on that people need to study from years past. And we've just accepted this current state of play to our detriment. And we've got to do some correction. I've talked to y'all about a summer of correction coming, and this is all part of it to me. We're going to reevaluate a hell of a lot because these dumbass students sitting around protesting and talking stupid shit, I'm tired of them. Already, it ain't even June. Shut the hell up with the foolishness. But I'm going to read this Daniel Patrick Moynihan piece, the first component. He broke it out into four parts. My plan, because it's a long ass opinion piece. My plan is to read it over a multiplicity of days, maybe two, maybe three. Today will just be part one. But I think it is important. I think it is very relevant to what the hell is going on today. It's very relevant to this time of deceit, right? And it's very relevant, again, on certain levels, I need to become color-coded in this discussion, the way I look at things. You just got to understand the way I look at things. And I think we have failed in this country. How do I say this? There are certain, given the course of the last few hundred years of history, white people have naturally navel-gazed, perhaps, at the development of their societies and their importance and impact on the world. They have been, Europeans, a dominant culture on the world stage. And the United States is not a European culture. Even as I say, we are largely an Anglo-Germanic nation with some Africano spice, okay? Not just some Africano spice, spice from all over the earth. This is what makes us unique in addition to our unique constitutional republic, grounded in an acknowledgement of God-given inalienable rights, okay? This is what makes us who we are. And we've zigged and we've zagged to the present day in a largely positive manner, okay? Largely. But we never want to make the perfect the enemy of the good, right? Never. I work very hard to not make the perfect the enemy of the good as I try to be this bridge builder that I think I am. So this is going to lead into the Moynihan piece. If you have not read it, I think it should be required reading. It is of the utmost importance that you read and digest this opinion piece. And what I think are some of the gems contained within it and some of the oversights. Okay, this is what discernment is all about, because a strong piece from 50 years ago is really informative today in ways that younger people don't get, especially when caught up in some of the information warfare put out by our side and by our adversaries. There are distractions aplenty, it seems to me. That's a personal opinion. And we need to be very careful. And this is why I say Occam's razor is our friend. Okay. Be careful going down the road of narratives. And anyway, let me play my first supportive ad. And then come back into this discussion of Moynihan after I check in with the chat. All right. Let's see if we can make this day work right. I forgot to tell you. I mean, I almost killed myself on Wednesday. I was so tired driving back to Jacksonville. I stopped multiple times. And I probably should have just pulled into a rest area and slept for a few hours. But it was afternoon when I got back to the Jacksonville area, and I did not want to come try and cross the Buckman Bridge. You just never know what you're going to get if it's a slowdown there. And as tired as I was, as patient as I was, it could have been a problem. So I came up through St. Augustine towards Mandarin. And there's just tremendous development, like all over Florida. And I hit an intersection, I think, around Roberts Road. There's major construction to expand the road. And I was getting ready to make a left. I saw only this single lane going in the direction I'm about to exit. And I was so tired, I did not see the other lane. I thought that thing had been totally blocked. But there was one lane still open. And here was an SUV barreling through, probably at speed's limit. But I started to turn right into it and suddenly saw it. And it's like, oh my goodness. Yeah, I got to go home and sleep. And I got to remember, yeah, I am getting older and I do get more tired. And there is an impact at this age of damn near 65 of getting tired more than it used to be. These are just some of the things I've got to come to terms with as an older gentleman. I just have to come to terms that I can't do. I just can't do what I used to do. Not as well, anyway. But still can do. First supportive ad.
Investigating covert CIA operations, investigating the CIA in general, is now off limits to the press, unless you have what Ted Turner called proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which when you're talking about covert operations, you're never going to find as a journalist.
Conspiracy theorists, kooks, crackpots.
You take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday of getting back at you.
We don't engage in assassinations and kidnappings and things of that kind. As far as I know, we never have.
One third of my staff in this task force was covert action, was propagandist.
Honestly, Twitter or X now is really where I get like all my news.
The unholy alliance between the intelligence community, social media platforms, and legacy media outlets.
And we will have to summon the same capacity to adapt to new circumstances and to meet changing times while upholding timeless ideals.
Fake, disgusting news.
It's one of those pieces of what we've seen around January 6th that is pushed by people that want to suggest that this attack was something other than what it really was.
This is why so many people can't stand the mainstream media and why there's a hardcore animosity towards the media that is pretty much commensurate equivalent to the animosity towards Congress.
Was that your laptop?
For real, I don't know.
You mean the laptop is now another Russia hoax?
This is where
he's going. The laptop is Russia,
gentlemen,
Russia,
gentlemen,
Russia.
I want to stay on the issue of rape.
We have an army of digital soldiers. This was irregular warfare at its finest.
Fuck you. War.
All right, now I am still hopeful of being allowed to do some type of prep on this Time of Deceit movie. So when it premieres May 1st, I, at the very least, I'm hopeful others in the Badlands Media Content Creator Network will be able to address it. We'll be able to have some nuggets, some pullouts, some shorts that we can, as a force multiplier community, put out to you as force multipliers in your own right to share with your circle of family and friends. This is, I think, an incredible opportunity for us. That movie is the beginning of what I see as a possible optimistic assault, I guess is the way I would put it. My wife wrote a dissertation on incredibly beautiful and smart woman who was working at Florida A&M University. She and her husband had theater backgrounds. And the fact of the matter is, you know, we talk so much about the CIA and we trash them. The Mann professor, considered by many the father of black college theater, S. Randolph Edmonds, was a part of the OSS. And he and his wife did take a troupe of theater students, the FAMU Playmakers Guild, on a tour of Africa in 1958 as a form of warfare to counter these motherfucking Russians. Okay? There's a long history from my research, going back to these damn Russians, okay? This isn't something narrowly taken. There's a reason for what you see and hear from me about them. There's a very strong reason. But I say all of that to say, there's a 1975 piece from Daniel Patrick Moynihan that is required reading to me by everybody in our little force multiplier group. Whether you're a content creator or just a viewer of this program, you need to read this piece. I'm going to read it in full over a period of days. It's long. And part one is going to take up quite a few minutes today. I hope I can get through it. I may make stops. I may get antagonized reading some stuff. It's just one of those things. But let me try and get into it and see if I can remember how to pull this bad boy up. I hope I've got it up on the right damn screen. It's like you'd be amazed how I forget to, here we go, get all of this stuff lined up. Now, and the way I do some of these documents, I make notes to myself and, I just, anyway, I see, you have to understand how I see some of this. And that first little line, a comment to myself, the utopian unreality contained within this essay. We're going to read, we'll get there. But I pulled out some stuff, and here's the language part of Moynihan's piece. Men sought a constitutional regime, he's talking about the British here, which disestablished ancient privilege, guaranteed liberties, and promoted the general welfare through what came to be known as liberal social policies. Samuel H. Beer describes the doctrine of British socialism as follows. It is especially the socialist commitment to fellowship that fundamentally distinguishes his approach. For private ownership, he would substitute public ownership. Regarding production of profit, he would use production for use. With respect to competition, he would prefer cooperation. A cultural and ethical revolution would also take place, and motives that had aimed at individual benefit would now aim at common benefits. Industry, which had been governed by individual decisions within the competitive system, would be subject to collective and democratic control. Government would consist in comprehensive and continuous planning and administration. Moynihan asked, is human reasoning ability capable of commanding the information necessary to design an ethical system? Christianity says no, it seems to me. Friedrich Hayek seems to agree. Bingo, bingo, bingo. We are still dealing with the consequences of Europe losing its way. Russians, Germans, British, all of them losing their damn way and forgetting about the limitations of this realm. This is the core problem. This is what Ayaan Hirsi Ali was addressing about these damn universities and the drift that they have suffered. We, in this summer of correction, are going to have to begin the process, a very serious process of correcting all of that shit. And you see part of it now, the disconnect. You see these dumbass Ivy League universities and some of these public universities who think of themselves as Ivy League universities allowing this dumbass shit. The University of Florida and the State University System of Florida ain't allowing that shit. And I'm pleased to see it. A whole bunch of other universities around the South are not allowing that shit. There is a summer of correction coming. Bank on it. All right, now let me get into it and let's see if I can work through this first part. This is the 1975 essay contained within Commentary Magazine, and it's titled The United States in Opposition. Here's how Daniel Patrick Moynihan begins his, let me see, how do I do full screen here? I'm probably going to mess something up, but hey, here we go. If you're watching the video, it's not getting bigger. Anyway, we are far from living in a single world community, writes Edward Shields, but the rudiments of a world society do exist. Among those rudiments, perhaps the most conspicuous, if least remarked, are the emerging views as to what kind of society it is. A measure of self-awareness has appeared, much as it did for smaller polities in earlier times. These assessments tend at the international level to be as diverse as those commonly encountered concerning national societies or local ones. Some will think the society is good and getting better. Others will see it as bad and getting worse. Some won't change. Some fear it. Where one sees justice, another sees wrong. The notion of a world society is nothing new to Americans. It dominated the rhetoric of World War II, of the founding of the United Nations, of much of the Cold War. It is now a received idea, and its impress may be measured by the success with which advocates have found audiences for issues defined in international terms. The world environmental problem, the world population problem, the world food problem. Not a generation ago, these were national issues at most. And a reminder, gang, this is 1975. He's writing this. Much of this internationalist rhetoric is based on things real enough. There is a world ecology. There is a world economy. Some measures important to individual countries can only be obtained through international accord. Thus, the concept of interdependence has become perhaps the main element of the new consciousness of a world society. This is a valid basis on which to posit the existence of a society. It is almost a precondition of a society's coming into being. Yet societies rarely stop at the acknowledgement of the need for cooperation, which is implied by the term interdependence. The image of a society as a family is a common one, and with reason. For in both cases, the idea of cooperation is frequently supplemented or even supplanted by the idea of obligation. What does one member owe another? This is something new in international pronouncements. If one were to characterize the discomfiture and distress with which Americans responded to the events of the 29th General Assembly of the United Nations in 1974, some measure would have to be attributed to the discovery that a vast majority of the nations of the world feel there are claims which can be made on the wealth of individual nations that are both considerable and threatening. In any event, threatening to countries such as the United States, which regularly finds itself in a minority, often a minority of one or two, or at most a half dozen, in an assembly of 138 members. The tyranny of the UN's new majority has accordingly been deplored, and there has been much comment that whereas opposition to the United Nations was once a position of conservatives in the United States, it is increasingly one of liberals also. Again, 1975. Yet while there have been some calls to boycott the General Assembly or not to vote in it, there have been but a few calls for withdrawal from the United Nations. That is no longer true. It is almost as if American opinion now acknowledged that there was no escaping involvement in the emergent world society. All the more reason then for seeking to understand just what in the hell has been going on. Part one. Now, of course, a lot is going on and no single element dominates. Yet it may be argued that what happened in the early 1970s is that for the first time, the world felt the impact of what, for lack of a better term, I shall call the British Revolution. That is the revolution which began in 1947 with the granting by socialist Britain of independence to socialist India. In slow and then rapid order, the great empires of the world, with the single major exception of the Tsarist Empire broke up into independent states. Note I then made to myself, this is an incredibly important note given the events of today and provides really valuable insight into what Russia's war against Ukraine is all about. Contrary to what many within our camp currently think, it's not about encroachment, and it never has been. Back to Moynihan. The original membership of the United Nations of 51 grew to 138. These new nations naturally varied in size, in terms of size, population, and resources. But in one respect, they hardly varied at all. To a quite astonishing degree, they were ideologically uniform, having fashioned their polities in terms derived from the general corpus of British socialist opinion as it developed in the period roughly between 1890 and 1950. The Englishmen and Irishmen, Scotsmen and Welsh, who created this body of doctrine and espoused it with such enterprise, nay, genius, thought they were making a social revolution in Britain. And they were. But the spread of their ideology to the furthest reaches of the globe, with its ascent to dominance in the highest national councils everywhere, gives to the British Revolution the kind of worldwide significance which the American and French and then the Russian revolutions possessed in earlier times. His footnote one reads thusly, the term British Revolution is open to objection as seeming to exclude the influence of continental socialism on the new nations. And indeed, a good case could be made for calling the phenomenon I am trying to describe the revolution of the Second International. But the term British can be justified by the fact that of the 87 states who have joined the United Nations since its founding, more than half, 47, have been part of the British Empire. Even apart from the empire, British culture was in the first half of this century incomparably the most influential in the world, and that culture was increasingly suffused with socialist ideas and attitude. Another note I made to myself. This has huge implications for my theory of American Revolution 2.0 and the remarkable continued influence the City of London Incorporated kept on global economics straight through the 20th century, an influence which is being methodically deconstructed by Donald Trump's Main Street versus Wall Street initiative. American Revolution 1.0, the 1776 variety, was about the governmental structure of things. American Revolution 2.0, the 2016 variety, is about the financial structure of things. Back to Moynihan's footnote. I anticipate and hope for a rigorous critique of the arguments of this paper, but I also hope it will not be too much distracted by the difficulties of finding a concise term to describe what was on the whole a concise phenomenon. The development of socialist doctrine and the formation of socialist parties in Western Europe at this time. I should also note that the political ideology in the new states of the Third World, of which I will be speaking, was best described by the late George Lichtenheim as National Socialism. This term has, of course, acquired an altogether unacceptable connotation. I then remark, an altogether unacceptable connotation, but an altogether accurate one that should not be glossed over. And it's important for Americans to understand this. All this shit we talk about Nazis is not a German unique thing. This is a European thing. All of these damn philosophies are of the left wing, including communism, this national socialism by the Nazis, this British freaking socialism, all of this crap is of the left wing. We need to not blink at that fact. They've worked very hard to talk about fascists as if they are of the right wing, and that is bullshit. Back to Moynihan. From the perspective of their impact on others, the American and French revolutions can be treated as a single event. They were not, of course, identical in themselves, and profoundly important distinctions can be made between them. But these distinctions were little noted in the political rhetoric of the century that followed, or in the forms of government fashioned in the likeness of this rhetoric, or in the goals of government so fashioned. Men sought a constitutional regime which disestablished ancient privilege, guaranteed liberties, and promoted the general welfare through what came to be known as liberal social policies. Liberalism was at first characterized by the opposition to state intervention in economic affairs, and later by the advocacy of such intervention. But the intervention in question was a fairly mild business, it being no liberal's view that the state was an especially trustworthy servant of the citizen. The citizen, as liberals viewed the world, was a very important person, especially perhaps if he tended to clean linen. The Russian Revolution of 1917 brought into existence a regime even more dramatically different from its predecessors than had the liberal regimes of a century earlier been for theirs. Everything, it was understood, had changed. Those who would change everything, or who believed that, like it or not, everything was going to change, rallied to this rhetoric. As for the rest of the world, it came soon enough to know that a wholly extraordinary event had occurred, even that the future had occurred. For 3 decades, culminating in the triumph of communist arms in China in 1948, this was quite the most vivid and the most attended to movement in the world. Note to myself here, the unacknowledged beginning of World War III, with its secretive / invisible Sun Tzu battle plan, immediately followed this triumph, and most of the world doesn't realize it yet. Back to Moynihan. The British Revolution of the second quarter of the 20th century attracted no such attention. Everyone certainly recognized that new states were coming into existence out of former European and indeed mostly British colonies, but the tendency was to see them as candidates for incorporation into one or the other of the older revolutionary traditions then dominant elsewhere in the world. It was not generally perceived that they were, in a sense, already spoken for, that they came to independence with a pre-existing, coherent, and surprisingly stable ideological base, which, while related to both the earlier traditions, was distinct from both. This most likely accounts for the almost incurious initial reaction in what would soon be known as the First and Second Worlds. In the Republic of India, the United States could see democracy. The Soviets could see socialism. In truth, a certain Hegelian synthesis had occurred. On the one hand, the minimal state of the American Revolution. In response, the total state of the Russian Revolution. In synthesis, the welfare state of the British Revolution. Again, a note to myself. And here, something of a blind spot is seriously exposed. Moynihan is quite representative of something of the white world. No thought, really and truly, of a world historic culture represented by the Chinese. In my opinion, even the Russians, I'm convinced, never quite understood what the Chinese were doing and are still doing. This is where Moynihan comes in with his Samuel H. Beer description. He describes the doctrine of British socialism as follows. It is especially the socialist commitment to fellowship that fundamentally distinguishes his approach. For private ownership, he would substitute public ownership. Regarding production of profit, instead production for use. On competition, instead cooperation. A cultural and ethical revolution would also take place, and motives that had aimed at individual benefit would now aim at common benefits. Industry, which had been governed by individual decisions within the competitive system, would be subject to collective and democratic control. Government would consist in comprehensive and continuous planning and administration. And I want to stop right here to say, are y'all seeing what I see here? Moynihan didn't see it. He saw something socialistic as totally separate and different from communism. But this was their genius of their decades-long approach, the march through the institutions, and how they were going to bring about the bullshit we see going on today. I don't even think the Russians recognized the full extent of this Sun Tzu thing the Chinese recognized in their decades-long play. Because the Russians think whatever the hell you want right now are subservient to the Chinese right now. Okay? Anyway, back to Moynihan. Two general points may be made about this British doctrine. First, it contained a suspicion of, almost a bias against, economic development, which carried over into those parts of the world where British culture held sway. The fundamental assertion of the age of the Diamond Jubilee was that there was plenty of wealth to go around if only it were fairly distributed. No matter what more thoughtful social analysts might agree, might urge, redistribution, not production, remains central to the ethos of British socialism. And that's communism. Profit became synonymous with exploitation. That profit might be something conceptually elegant, least cost production, made scarcely any impress. Production for profit became a formulation for all that was wrong in the old ways. The Tories half agreed, for it was the liberals and the radicals who were being repudiated by such doctrine, and it was the Liberal Party that went under. This too was passed on. When Arthur Lewis in 1974 gave the Tata lectures in India and found himself pleading as a socialist and a man of the third world, but also an economist, that profit was not a concept public sector enterprise could afford to ignore. No less a personage than the head of the Indian Planning Commission felt called upon to rebut him. To be sure, much of this redistributionist bias was simply innocent. British socialists, for example, proved in office to know almost nothing about how actually to redistribute income, and British income has not been significantly redistributed. Coming to power just after World War II, the socialists appeared to think that they had abolished wealth by imposing a top income tax rate of 19 shillings 6 pence in the 20 shilling pound, which is to say confiscating the rich man's pay envelope. Few seem to note that capital gains remained exempt from income tax altogether, so that in large measure thereafter, only those with property could acquire property, the very antithesis of the social condition socialism sought. This detail perhaps did not escape the well-to-do of the developing nations when the prospect of socialism on the British model first appeared there. And I'd say you see it in the left wing in this country today, don't you? I mean, they don't give a damn about we the people, but they do give a damn about their money. The second general point about socialist doctrine as it developed in Britain was that it was anti-American, more anti-American surely than it was ever anti-Soviet. Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. The reasons for this are not that obscure. The British were not overmuch admiring of Americans in that era, nor we of them. In part, their attitude began as aristocratical disdain. An intimate of Pandit Nehru's describes once asking India's first prime minister why he was so anti-American. This was in 1961. Nehru's first reaction was a rather huffy denial of any such predisposition. But he then became reflective and after a moment admitted, yes, it was true, and that it probably all dated back to his days at Harrow. There was one American boy there at the time, filthy rich and much too pushy. But more importantly, of course, America was seen as quintessentially capitalist. With the Russian Revolution, and then especially with the World Depression of the 1930s and the onset of Popular Front movements in Europe, a considerable number of British socialists, despite their party's fundamental and central attachment to democratic processes, became supporters of the Soviet regime. Russia was the future. America was the past. With the coming of the Cold War, this attitude became institutionalized and almost compulsory on the British left. New Statesman, a journal which tended to follow Asian and African graduates after they had left Britain and returned home, became damn near Stalinist in its attachment to Soviet ways with the world and its pervasive antagonism to things American. And yet the New Statesman was never communist, and neither, save in small proportion, were its readers. Another note to myself, this was a serious mistake by Moynihan, and as history has proven, of the American left wing as well. We are currently paying the price for their naivete on this score. Back to Moynihan. They were British socialists, part of a movement of opinion which spread in the course of the first half of the 20th century to the whole of the British Empire, a domain which covered one quarter of the Earth's surface and which an inspired cartographic convention had long ago decreed to be colored pink. It was British civil servants who took the doctrine to the colonies. How curious, in retrospect, are the agonizings of Harold Laski and others as to whether the civil service would carry out the policies of a socialist government. What more congenial task for persons whose status comes from the power and prestige of government? But in the Britain of that era, it could be thought that class origin would somehow overcome occupational interest. But the civil service began, British education completed. Has there ever been a conversion as complete as that of the Malay, the Igbo, the Gujarati, the Jamaican, the Australian, the Cypriot, the Guyanan, the Yemenite, the Yoruban, the Sabra, the Fellaheen to this distant creed? The London School of Economics, Shills notes, was often said to be the most important institution of higher education in Asia and Africa. In her autobiography, Beatrice Webb wrote that she and her husband felt assured that the London School of Economics as the teaching body, with the Fabian Society as a propagandist organization, with the London County Council as object lesson and electoral success, with their books as the only elaborate original work in economic fact and theory, no young man or woman who is anxious to study or to work in public affairs can fail to come under our influence. For reasons that are understandable, this was true most particularly for young men and women coming from abroad in that long and incongruously optimistic intellectual age that began amid late Victorian plumpness and ended with the austerity of post-war Britain. In 1950, the conservative Michael Oakeshott succeeded to the Fabian Harold Laski's chair in political theory at the London School of Economics. And in that sense, the party was over. But by then, not communists, but Fabians could claim that the largest portion of the world's population lived in regimes of their fashioning. Before very long, the arithmetical majority and the ideological coherence of those new nations brought them to dominance in the United Nations and indeed in any world forum characterized by universal membership. I think I'm going to stop there and get my next group of supportive advertisements out of the way and maybe, just maybe, leave that be and just have a conversation today on whatever is on your mind, either from this reading or what's going on today with the Trump trials, et cetera, because it is all related to what is contained within this piece. I would say if you have time over the weekend, definitely try and take time to read this incredible piece, The United States in Opposition, because it is a history lesson that few people provide today. The context of it, few pieces provide this kind of context as you understand the damn near global success of these communists to plant seeds that are bearing fruit everywhere, most especially with the young and dumb. And we see it in spades. That's why Donald Trump has been attacked so vehemently. That's why this document right here, ladies and gentlemen, explains to you why that July 27 speech he gave in Warsaw was attacked so viciously by the left wing. They are all pimping for these communists, whether knowingly or not. and the communists driving the train these days are the Chinese. I'm just saying. Okay, let me, let's see. I did stop that so I can go play my ad. And first.
Investigating covert CIA.
Yeah, I played that already. America's General.
Sounds rolling. All three cameras, we're good.
Is there any regrets that you have in life? I should sit here and say, I got a lot of regrets. But when I look back on my life and I understand the lives that were lost, I mean, I'm sitting here with you. And I can tell my story.
Former National Security Advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty today for lying to the FBI.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
He was, by definition, the most dangerous possible person for Donald Trump to hire.
Only brilliant military career serving 33 years.
Why was he being so elusive?
Mike Flynn told the truth and faced life in prison.
Next up, River BTC. Are you ready, ladies and gentlemen, to diversify your assets with Bitcoin? We're introducing River, the official Bitcoin partner of Badlands Media, where you can navigate the world of Bitcoin with confidence. With River, you can buy Bitcoin like a pro. With the assurance of being licensed and regulated right here in the United States, River ensures your Bitcoin journey is smooth and secure with on-demand live support at your fingertips. River empowers you to grow your portfolio without any unwanted surprises and eliminates third-party custodians, putting you in control of your assets. Open an account with no minimum purchase requirement. You can get your Bitcoin journey started with just one single dollar. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/river to create your River account today. That's badlandsmedia.tv/river. River Bitcoin, shaping the future of finance. One Bitcoin at a time. All right. Let me get into the chat. Now that I've checked that block, and let's see how we're doing here. Good morning, MAGA Keys. Good morning, Bushido. Good morning, T. Augustine. Good morning, Eurythmic. Good morning, Dina. Me 53. Good morning to you. Yeah, these stunts are a distraction, but they also serve as something of a way to try and capture your mind. You know, they want to generate a certain amount of frustration and fear among Americans, thinking that our students are more off track than they are. We've got dumbasses, to be sure. But no, these are provocateurs in the mix, leading dumbasses. Okay, and you're going to have that in every young generation. You're going to have young and dumb. And that's basically what we have going on here. Med beds, 4 degrees in the 80s. The system is what woke me up. Yeah, I just remember how earnestly people were talking about the coming global freeze. And then they deny talking that. And it's like, no, motherfucker, I lived it. I had the classes. I saw all of this crap. You can't lie to me. University funding by Epstein, Soros, cabal is at the root of the cancer in corporate America 100%. But I, MedBeds, tried to make the point. And into next week, I'm going to try and tighten it up. I was just too tired this week to really. Part of this thing I wanted to try and talk about with Elon Musk and how they are targeting him, how they have manipulated the Tesla stock downward. And any rational review can see this is going to be one of the most successful corporations in world history, maybe the most. And they keep talking dumbass shit, you know, about this, that, and the other, and people buying into this fear, uncertainty, and doubt. Tesla is sitting so pretty with billions of dollars in the bank. It's absurd just to watch this manipulation. Okay, but that's part of it. That cabal, BlackRock is involved. Many of these mega corporations are involved because they then push this ESG bullshit as a form of control and nothing but control. It's part of what they're trying to do with Bitcoin. They've bowed down after trying to crash Bitcoin and finding out they couldn't. They've bowed down now to trying to co-opt it. It's part of what FTX was all about. It was an attempt to co-opt Bitcoin by emulating the fiat system, faking shit, pulling Bitcoins out of their ass. And you had these tokens that supposedly represented Bitcoin that would have allowed for parasitical middlemen to continue driving the train. This is everything that's going on now, where they see existential threat. And I'm talking about the banksters and the corporations, the globalists, even the damn Russians and the Chinese, because you do understand, if the intelligence community of Russia is driving their train, meaning controlling their oligarchs and corporations, if the Communist Chinese Party is driving their train, meaning controlling their businesses, did you see what they did to Jack Ma? A little bit of independence and he's off the scene. Gone. They've confiscated the money. All of these teams who sometimes compete with one another are always competing against us, we the people, even these dumbasses within our country. Okay, that's part of what's going on. This is part of what is why Donald Trump as disruptor in chief within the governmental structure and Elon Musk as disruptor in chief in the commercial structure is being attacked mercilessly. This is a fight to the death, ladies and gentlemen. You gotta understand how important this fight is. We cannot lose this fight. Okay. I saw that MAGA Keys. They interviewed that girl. They could interview, I think, the large majority of these students. They're not going to know. Look, some of these people, I remember being a student, okay? Okay, I remember being young. Your hormones are popping. Some of these guys are chasing some of these girls. Some of these girls are chasing some of these guys and everything in between. That's what's happening on a lot of this stuff. They don't care about Palestine. Are you kidding? They're just going to chant and do some stuff and be rebellious and feel just good about being rebellious. It don't mean a damn thing. It doesn't mean a damn thing. We do have to keep our eyes on the prize, Eurythmic. We do have to focus. I think we can't fall down into a trap of despair, which is what they want. We're in much better shape than people realize. And if you see the way those black people responded to Donald Trump and Chick-fil-A, if you see him being up there in Harlem and, hey, you know what? They're singing the national anthem. We have these people on the run. They are desperate. The jig is just about up. We just have to continue to march, methodically support our competent professionals who are more competent than many people want to admit. I will also say, if you don't support this Ukraine war, please take a step back and think it through a little bit more. He has fooled them. He has fooled them. They're supporting something he supports. You can think whatever the hell you want. They are supporting something he supports. And you want to talk about something? People keep talking about black swan events and what's going to make a fucking head explode. There might be something along those lines that comes out and makes their fucking head explode. I'm just saying. You do need preparers. I don't know that you need to go full prepper. I do think Team Trump I don't want to say it has protected us, but you do need to protect. You do need to protect yourself. You do need to be armed. You do need to be ready, because there is going to be some bullshit. These people are desperate. I don't think they have a shot, but they are desperate, and desperate people don't think rationally. No, the Ukraine funding, Eurythmic, one day we're going to have this conversation and you are going to see, okay? You're going to see. Please quit disrespecting Sweden. Please quit disrespecting these Baltic states. Please quit disrespecting Poland. Huh? You're listening to communists. Russia is still communist. You do understand that. Yesterday, they arrested the Minister of Defense's number two. Now, I'm just telling y'all, you think whatever the hell you want. Oh, man, I've run out of time. The Siloviki in Russia are about to eat their own. Russia is in bad shape. Okay? They are beginning to enter a death spiral, even as they've got their agents sitting here saying, the war is lost, Ukraine cannot win, blah, 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 blah. Shut the hell up with that foolishness. Okay, back next week with more of this United States in opposition throughout the week, and I'll try and talk about the relevance of it all, because it is going to become ever more clear in this summer of correction that is upon us. All right, with that, I'm going to say later, Gators. I hope y'all have a great weekend. I'm going to dive into this draft stuff and consume it all, and back Monday.
Friends, first off, thank you so very much for joining us. We truly and deeply appreciate your continued support and love shown to us here at Badlands Media. Don't forget to hit the thumbs up on this video and help get this show on the Rumble leaderboard. Another way you can support Badlands for free? Become a Badlander. How do you do that? Head on over to badlandsmedia.tv, click connect from the top menu, and then click be a Badlander. Once you're registered, you can download clips from your favorite Badlands shows to share on your social media accounts. You can also print out flyers and stickers that you can hand out at an event and more. Let's keep growing our community, because we are the news now and we take that very seriously. Thank you again from Badlands for your support and your love. It is appreciated more than you know.